prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, going solo today as Melody takes care of other important business. For all your gold and silver needs, call us at toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Thursday, April 27th, 2023. Hey, happy National Teach Your Children to Save Day. A mouthful, yes, but look, it's a great day to get your offspring and grandkids, nephews, nieces started on their way to building their own nest egg for emergencies, for college or technical school, a future car or house, and of course for retirement. It's never too early for that, is it? Let's head to the market report today, where gold just a minute ago jumped up, I guess 60 cents. in the New York spot market, $1,990. That was, on news of downbeat GDP in the U.S., although the World Bank sees gold, which rose 9% in the first quarter, outperforming other commodities the rest of the year with continued safe haven demand. Silver up roughly 0.2% at $25. Platinum down $9, $1,088. And palladium down $8, about 0.5% at $1,576. That's on the heels of U.S. dollar, which, come on, where are we? We're frozen here. Bear with me. I'm sorry about that. Gosh, that's embarrassing. I hate when that happens. There we go. Just barely up. I'm almost going to call it flat at 101.5, the U.S. dollar index. Oil up 6.65%, about 48 cents a barrel, 74.78 per barrel. Natural gas up a little over 2% today at 2.358. The 10-year yield up roughly a tenth of a percent at 3.52. The 2-year and 3 months still exceeding it by a good bit. The 2-year 4.1, we'll call it. That was also up. 3-month T-bill also up. Looks about 5 basis points at 5.2%. A significant inverse yield curve. Just showing a recession flashing in the offing. In the paper markets, the equities, just about all major exchanges up except the FTSE. That was down about 0.3% in the U.S. Dow Jones up 1.5%, 524 to close at 33,826. Despite the GDP report, that's a lot of positive earnings calls today. The NASDAQ up to roughly 2.5%, 288 at 12,142. And the S&P up about 2%, 79 points, close at 4,135. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, speaking of growth, GDP growth in the U.S. slowed considerably during the first 3 months of 2023 as interest rate increases and inflation took hold of an economy that largely expected to slow down even further in the coming months. GDP, which is a measure of all goods and services produced during a given period, rose at a 1.1% annualized pace following a fourth quarter increase of 2.6% and 2.1% for all of 2022. The report also showed significantly that the personal consumption expenditures price index, that's the inflation measure, some say is preferred by the Federal Reserve, increased 4.2, down actually substantially from last year and continues to slightly fall, but still twice the goal of the Fed's 2% target. Now, high inflation and slow growth is sometimes described as stagflation, which, as we know, characterized the late 70s and early 80s economy here in the U.S. The slowdown in growth in the first quarter came as a result of a decline in private inventory investment and a deceleration in non-residential fixed investment. The investment slowdown, in fact, took the inventory, slowdown took over 2.2 percentage points off the headline GDP number. Consumer spending, measured by the PCE, increased 3.7 annualized, and exports were up 4.8%. Gross private domestic investment, on the other hand, tumbled over 12%. Economist Jeffrey Roach at LPL Financial says the U.S. economy is likely at an inflection point as consumer spending has softened in recent months. He added the backward nature of the GDP report is possibly misleading for markets. As we know, consumers were still spending in January, but since March have pulled back as consumers are getting more pessimistic about the future. More on that in a minute. The report comes as the Fed is seeking to slow an economy burdened by inflation that, as we've reported ad nauseum, has been running or had been running at its highest level in more than four decades. And in its policy tightening regime that began last March, the Fed has raised its benchmark interest rates by 4.75 percentage points, taking it to the highest level in about 16 years. And as of this morning, anyway, 80% of Fed funds future traders believe it will go up another 25 basis points at the Fed's next policy making meeting on May 3rd. Is that next week? Gosh, how quickly it flies. Though inflation's pulled back some from its peak of around 9% last June, it remains well above the Fed's target, as I mentioned. Fed policymakers, all of them, in fact, say inflation is still too high and will require elevated interest rates for some time. We will see. There's some projecting in the futures market that rates will start coming down as early as this summer. At the same time, growth has taken a hit, especially from troubles in the banking sector that are likely to infect the economy further ahead. More on that as well in this program. Those two issues, the banking situation and inflation, the Fed's rate hiking cycle, and the expected credit crunch ahead. They're expected to tilt the economy into recession sometime this year. Consumers, though, remain fairly resilient despite their pessimism and are expected to use their excess savings still left over from the pandemic and the resulting purchasing power declining as much as it has, nevertheless, to make the economic downturn short and shallow. We will see. I'll talk more about some of this stuff, particularly how we'll know we're in a recession in today's third segment. Now, speaking of unemployment and jobless claims, it's Thursday, and that means another jobless claims report has hit the streets. Labor Department reported this morning that despite Amazon, Disney, and several other companies continuing to lay off thousands of workers, the number of Americans filing jobless claims for the first time last week declined. 230,000 of us filed for unemployment insurance during the week ending April 22nd, down about 16,000 from the week before. Unemployment insurance claims are seen as a proxy for layoffs, which ballooned during the pandemic as companies shut down and supply chains became entangled, but have since slowed as the economy stabilized and many businesses struggled to find employees. Now, the moving average of jobless claims over the past 4 weeks, which gives a broader, more accurate view of the unemployment picture, sort of smoothing out week-to-week volatility, was 236,000, about 4,000 fewer than the revised average from the previous week. So a trend, I guess, heading in a good direction for workers, not so much for what the Fed is looking for. In total, about 1.86 million were receiving unemployment insurance during the week ending April 15th. So that was down slightly, 3,000 from the week before. Now, despite the decline in claims, jobless claims, layoffs have been rattling industries, particularly tech, but also media in recent months. This week, Walt Disney began its second round of job eliminations, cutting several thousand positions as part of a broader plan to cut 7,000 jobs that will affect various divisions, including its TV networks, ESPN. I don't know if ABC's part of that, and its theme parks. Amazon also initiated its latest rounds of cuts yesterday. Amazon said last month it would be getting rid of 9,000 more jobs. Cuts following the elimination of roughly 18,000 other positions in recent months. And several other companies, including McDonald's, Lyft, and Meta, Facebook parent, have announced they're slashing more, citing reasons ranging from declining ad revenue to just an overall need to streamline, presumably ahead of a coming recession. Much attention has been paid to these waves of job cuts, particularly in the tech industry, where literally tens of thousands of jobs have been shed, well into the six figures now. But a key reason that sector appears so hard hit is that it was so aggressive in hiring workers before the pandemic. In the 5 years preceding the beginning of COVID here in the U.S., tech companies added 1.3 million workers, according to the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics. Of course, the pandemic accelerated the need for more tech workers to get products to consumers who were increasingly shopping online and who also had additional cash to buy whatever, gaming systems, computers, and other electronics. Thanks to the stimulus checks, at least in part, from the government and enhanced federal unemployment benefits. But that extra money, as we know, has been drying up. In some cases, it's all but dried up, and consumers are pulling back on their spending, even though they still have some pent-up savings. Plus, the Fed's interest rate increases have been sending tech stocks literally plunging, with companies laying off workers they no longer need or said they could no longer afford to keep on the payroll. And speaking of tech, excuse me one second. Well, it's good to see that some countries are finally trying to limit the reach of monopolies and the anti-competitive nature of their sheer size. The UK, their Competition and Markets Authority's decision to block Microsoft's proposed acquisition of the big game Call of Duty maker Activision means a bunch of things, but primarily, it means the U.S. doesn't need to stand alone in its challenge of this massive $69 billion deal. And the latest hurdle for Microsoft and its proposed deal, the CMA argued the acquisition threatens to hurt competition in the growing cloud gaming market. But it didn't challenge potential competition concerns in console gaming, after saying last month that evidence from the industry convinced them that the transaction wouldn't harm competition in that particular market. So that's not good. It makes the CMA stance a narrower one than the argument that the U.S.'s Federal Trade Commission made in December when it challenged the deal before its internal administrative law judge. The FTC claimed that the proposed acquisition would likely reduce competition or create monopolies in markets for gaming subscription services, cloud gaming, and high-performance consoles. The CMA's decision is a mixed bag for the challenge here in the U.S., in part because it didn't move forward with the theory about harm to the console market. That's according to Daniel Francis, anyway. He's a law professor at New York University and also a former deputy director of the FTC's Bureau of Competition. And the theory it did advance about cloud gaming relies on a concept of harm to future competition, which U.S. courts may look at more skeptically. Francis said, ultimately, the CMA seems to have chosen a path where the FTC may find it harder to follow. Now, while having another major regulator also find competition issues in the deal may be encouraging for the FTC, the road ahead is still not straightforward. That's given the high burden on the government in antitrust cases here in our country and a generally different perspective on competition law. According to Rebecca Hall Allensworth, she's an antitrust professor at Vanderbilt University Law School, European regulators' willingness to look at the future and make some guesses about what the competitive environment would or will be in a few years is appropriate and something that we struggle with more in the U.S. Now, while Microsoft said it remains committed to the acquisition and plans to appeal the CMA's decision, Francis said that's difficult to do, and it's common for parties like Microsoft to abandon acquisitions at this stage. Regulators for the EU as a whole are still reviewing the transaction for competition. Now, we're almost out of time here in the first segment, so I'm just going to get started with this story, and we'll finish it after the break. Some market observers see California's First Republic Bank as a valuable franchise saddled with a terrible balance sheet. And with that music, it's time for a couple of important messages. I hope you'll stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen sitting in for Melody today, 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver needs. Now, again, right before the break, we were talking about California's First Republican Bank, which is or has been seen as a valuable company with a terrible balance sheet. These observers say if it managed to offload $100 billion of its assets, it wouldn't be hard to find private equity investors willing to capitalize what's left of the bank to the tune of a few billion dollars. The catch? Those assets are worth a lot less than book value, thanks to rising interest rates largely, and First Republic doesn't have enough capital to absorb the loss of selling them at market prices. Therefore, the assets would have to be sold at some lower figure below book value, but above their market value. The natural buyers would be the too big to fail banks led by J.P. Morgan Chase, which already have $30 billion on deposit at First Republic as part of their recent mini bailout. Whatever you call $30 billion mini. They could hold the assets to maturity, for example, pocket a profit and effectively rescue First Republic by doing so. And in return, they'd receive warrants or other sweeteners from that bank. Now, if the big boys collectively bought First Republic assets, either directly or via some kind of special purpose vehicle, would that be better for them as a group than seeing it fail? There's a collective action problem here, which is why the government needs to use some moral suasion to push a preferably private solution. In its latest earnings release on Monday, First Republic said the bank is pursuing strategic options to expedite its progress while reinforcing its capital position. Wow. Now, others are saying that one way or another, the federal government is going to have to get involved in determining the future of First Republic Bank. They say when an eventual resolution comes, whether it's a matter of days rather than weeks, if First Republic management gets its way, it will unavoidably have government fingerprints all over it. Banking crisis that was precipitated by the failure of Silicon Valley Bank last month is now largely in the past. First Republic is the last major unresolved question mark at this point. Emphasis on at this point. If it fails, the broader crisis could easily flare up again. First Republic would almost certainly be insolvent if it had to sell all of its assets at their market value. And that's eroding trust in the bank, which has already lost $100 billion in customer deposits. First Republic bonds maturing in 2046 are trading at 43 cents on the dollar, according to Bond Ticker, and that implies their equity is largely worthless. Broadly speaking, there are likely two options for the bank. Either it fails, that is, allowed to fail, or it manages to continue as a going concern. From a public policy perspective, clearly the latter is preferable, but if a bailout is coming, what role should the government play, if any? Well, here are two possible solutions. Options. First Republic fails is the first one. In this scenario, the government will face the choice of whether or not to extend FDIC insurance to all uninsured depositors, of which there are a lot. On the other hand, if the FDIC didn't declare First Republic systemically important, that is, then that could precipitate another full-blown banking crisis with deposits fleeing all but the largest banks. Now, option two, First Republic doesn't fail. If it's recapitalized over the next few days or weeks, it's likely to retain both most of the financial advisors in its wealth management unit and the loyalty of its existing or what remains of its customer base. The longer it exists in its current zombie state, however, the more its franchise value erodes, the harder it will be to put together a package to rescue it. Basically, First Republic isn't in charge of its fate anymore. But Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen isn't known as a dealmaker like some of her predecessors were, and so it's not clear at all whether she's inclined to intervene. So the fate of First Republic probably rests in the hands of two big-to-fail banks and the FDIC, unless that is Jay Powell, the Fed, comes galloping for an 11th-hour rescue. Stay tuned. We'll keep you abreast. Hey, it's time for our weekly segment now. Levity is golden. Today's topic is one of unintended consequences of the pandemic with the growth of working from home. Now, during the pandemic, golf, of all things, was the official sport of social distance. Now it's settling in as the official sport of remote work. The pandemic-fueled golf boom has yet to go bust, thanks in large part, some say, to the incredible rise of midweek golf. That's according to a recent study from Stanford University. Using geolocation data near golf courses in the U.S., researchers found that 83% more golf games were played on weekdays in August 2022 compared to August 2019. In 2019, there were 12,700 golf course trips on Mondays, 11,400 on Tuesdays, 10,008 on Wednesdays, and 15,000 on Thursdays. In 2022, those numbers were, listen to this, 24,400, 25-8, 26-2, and 26-3 in 2022 on Thursdays. Turns out that Wednesday afternoons have seen the biggest transformation. 278% more golf trips were made at 4 p.m. on a Wednesday in August 2022 versus 2019. So says the study. One golf course manager told the Stanford researchers, every course, every minute is now packed throughout the week. No more quiet Wednesdays. I suspect that may be giving some of the courses more trouble accepting large group outings. Hopefully not, because they typically benefit local charities. Millions of Americans who started working remotely 3 years ago are now set in these new routines and are more comfortably leveraging their flexibility. And that's created huge demand for leisure activities, whether it's golf or yoga, and a large swath of the country is participating in the growing afternoon fun economy, as it's becoming known as. Not since Tiger Woods came onto the professional golf scene a few decades ago has this sport, golf, seen such a fundamental change. 27% of paid full-time work days in the U.S. were done from home at the start of this year, according to the Stanford researchers. The last word from an anonymous California tech executive who was cited in the study said this: I think my colleague was taking his Zoom call from the golf course. He was on mute with video off, but once when he was talking, I heard somebody talking about the fairway and strokes. We live in interesting times, ladies and gentlemen. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Hey, they're $200 billion poorer than last year, but still worth a collective $2.1 trillion. Pity these 2,640 billionaires across the planet. It was a down year for them, including those at the very top of the top. Yes, the richest people in the world are now worth a combined $2.1 trillion, according to Forbes' latest World's Billionaire list released today. That's down a combined $200 billion from $2.3 trillion the year before. Not even a nearly $40 billion divorce could topple Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos from being the world's richest person again. For the third year in a row, Bezos landed in the top spot. His net worth fell $18 billion last year to $113 billion, according to Forbes, partially due to his high-profile divorce from Mackenzie Bezos. Mackenzie also made her first appearance on the list thanks to the $38 billion divorce settlement. As part of that settlement, she got 25% of the couple's Amazon stock and now ranks 22nd on Forbes' list. Good for her. For the first half of March, 226 people lost their billionaire status. And there are 58 fewer billionaires compared to the same time last year. In total, Forbes counted 2,095 billionaires. Forbes said, quote, of the billionaires who remain, 51% are poorer than they were last year. In raw terms, the world's billionaires are worth $8 trillion, all of them down $700 billion from 2019. Well, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates is in second place with $98 billion. That's an increase of $1.5 billion. Bernard Arnault, chair and CEO of the luxury magnate LVMH, nudged out Warren Buffett for third place with $76 billion. At $67.5 billion, Buffett's now in fourth place. Still not too chintzy, I'd say. The world's richest woman continues to be Walmart heir Alice Walton. She's in ninth place with $54.4 billion. Now, besides Mackenzie Bezos, there are 177 other fresh faces that grace Forbes' list for the first time. Eric Yuan, who's the founder and CEO of Zoom, which I just mentioned, is number 293 at $5.5 billion. his company stock blew up once the teleconference software started being widely used by people, again, working from home during the pandemic. It's since lost a decent amount of its capital capitalization. Another newcomer, Anthony Von Mandel. He's the CEO of Mark and Anthony Brands, which created White Claw, the country's top-selling hard seltzer drink that I had at my niece's wedding last year for the first time and really enjoyed it. It's become a phenomenon for people craving a guilt-free, boozy beverage. Anthony's worth an estimated $3.3 billion and sits at number 590. Julia Koch, the influential Koch Industries, is also new with a net worth of $38.2 billion. She jumped to 18th place after she and her children received a 42% stake in their company, Koch Industries, after her husband, David, died a couple of years ago. Rounding out the top 10, now, you know what? That's enough time spent on billionaires. Let's just see what's next. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky said he and Chinese President for life Xi Jinping had a long and meaningful phone call yesterday. It was their first known contact since Russia invaded Ukraine over a year ago, and Beijing appointed an envoy to pursue a political settlement. The hour-long call came 2 months after Beijing, which has long been aligned with Russia, said it wanted to act as a mediator. And a month after she visited, Moscow and met with Putin. The call also coincided with indications that Ukraine is readying its forces for a major spring counteroffensive. Zelensky was upbeat about the conversation, which offered him the chance to insert his views into what had been a bilateral dialogue between Moscow and Beijing. Putin's obviously eager to keep Xi close as a counterweight to the U.S., which, of course, is sided with Ukraine. Zelensky said, "I believe that this call, as well as the appointment of Ukraine's ambassador to China, will give a powerful impetus to the development of our bilateral relations." An official readout on Zelensky's website called the conversation productive and said it leads the way toward possible interaction with the aim of establishing a just and sustainable peace. White House also described it as a positive development, allowing Xi to hear Ukraine's view of the illegal, unprovoked invasion. Moscow Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova commended China's approach, praising Beijing's readiness to strive to establish a peace negotiation process. But as many foreign policy experts are saying, whether this leads to any meaningful negotiations is doubtful. The consensus is that this is a war which will likely be decided on the battlefield. Now, back to the U.S., the mortgage rate shock has refocused home builders' attention on an underserved segment, the first-time home buyer, which they've been losing a lot of. Since the mid-2000s housing boom ended with a disastrous financial crisis in 2008, builders have mostly focused on larger, more expensive houses, McMansions, as they're called in some parts, the kind that are out of reach for entry-level buyers. But now sale activity in existing homes, the vast majority of houses, has slowed to nearly a standstill. High prices and surging mortgage rates have hammered affordability and made those who already own their homes leery of moving. And then that's suppressing the inventory of existing homes on the market for sale. So at the risk of stating the obvious, first-time buyers don't already own a home, so they're not stuck in place by a sweet low mortgage. And with fewer than usual existing homes in the market for these entry-level buyers, builders are seeing an opportunity. Economist Bob Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders says it's a renewed focus given the lack of inventory. First-time buyers, he adds, are going to play a key role in the order expansion for home builders going forward. And that will take us into our second break. Again, you're listening to Financial Survival. I hope you'll stick around for our third segment. Please listen to these important messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Dave Allen yakking at you today. Melody will be back tomorrow. Boy, I'll tell you, it's listening to songs like that that make me wish I were standing to do this program rather than comfortably sitting. That song really gets you moving or makes you want to move. Hey, Americans who are retiring now are tending to go it alone. They're the first generation to rely on private savings instead of pensions to navigate the financial vortex of retirement. 401k plans and IRAs don't generate steady and predictable income like defined benefit pensions or even Social Security. Results a feeling of perpetual insecurity, even among those who've amassed substantial savings. When your retirement relies on a fixed pool of money, like a 401k or IRA, it becomes almost impossible to answer this simple question. How much income do I have? The retiree, rather than any fund administrator, ultimately decides how much money to withdraw every month or quarter or whatever. And a paycheck isn't just income. It also serves as a simple way of setting a monthly budget. When paychecks go away, retirees with savings are finding it very difficult to know how much money it's safe to spend every month because none of us knows how many years we have left to live. And some of us have other plans for that money, like giving a chunk away to your kids, grandkids, or your church, or whatever. Now, resurgent inflation makes such calculations even harder. Again, since none of us know how much more expensive our spending habits will become over our remaining years, for most retired Americans, many of whom retired as long ago as the last century, which really is just 23 years ago, so guaranteed income still covers more than half of their total monthly spending. Today's retirees find themselves in a much more uncertain situation and volatile to boot, with a host of spending needs, some foreseeable, some coming out of the blue, but all needing to be funded out of a volatile and unpredictable retirement portfolio. In a recent survey by Too Big to Fail Goldman Sachs, 45% of current retirees, including 54% of females, said they found entering retirement to be somewhat or very stressful in terms of financial anxiety. The number one unexpected financial challenge in retirement is understanding what income will be. But the most important feature of retirement income is that it be consistent and stable month over month. And those numbers are sure to rise as guaranteed incomes make up an ever smaller portion of retirement income. Are you recently retired or planning to retire soon? If so, let us know about your experience. Drop me a line at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. Dave Allen, A-L-L-E-N, one word, .usa@yahoo.com. Tell me your story, concerns, and any questions. If you approve, we'll discuss your situation, of course, keeping your name confidential, on a future financial survival program. Thanks. All right. So politicians are once again locked at a standoff over raising the national debt ceiling, with Republicans in control of the House saying they just won't do it unless President Biden makes concessions on spending. And Biden, on the other hand, says no negotiations. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy got enough of his Republican colleagues to pass a big spending cut bill yesterday. But everyone in Washington, anyway, agrees it has no chance of passing the democratically controlled Senate. And even if it did, members of the House Freedom Caucus, who got McCarthy elected as Speaker in January, are saying they won't vote for a watered-down version of the bill after the D's get their hands on it. Experts say the situation could enter uncharted and dangerous territory this summer if the government runs out of options and can no longer borrow money to pay its bills. Ever since January, the government's been running its finances on borrowed time. That month, the Treasury reached its $31.4 trillion limit that Congress, under current law, allows the government to owe to pay for obligations it's already authorized. Accounting maneuvers by the Treasury, called extraordinary measures, have kept the lights on at government agencies since then and have continued paying Social Security benefits, military salaries, and the government's other bills while the R's and D's try to avert the unthinkable. Experts are now saying there are three possible ways the situation could play out. First, Congress raises or suspends the debt limit, as they always have, and probably will be again. I mean, the likely possibility is that a deal of some sort is reached at the last minute. This crisis fizzles out for a couple of months, maybe even a year, and everything goes back to business as usual. Not necessarily a good thing. Since 1960, Congress has raised or suspended the debt limit 78 times, and the country's never defaulted on its debt in the modern era. So why should this time be any different? Number two, there's no deal, and the government finds itself unable to pay the bills. In the most dire scenario, the government would stop paying its trillion-dollar-plus obligations on time, dealing a far-reaching blow to an economy already sliding toward a recession. Indeed, failure is an option. In the event of a prolonged standoff, the government would be forced to slash spending, they say, by $350 billion. Economists say that would send a cataclysmic ripple effect through the economy and undermining the confidence of consumers, financial markets, investors, and businesses alike. The economic fallout would be similar to the Great Recession, they predict, and the headline unemployment rate would more than double, spiking to over 8%, which in reality means probably double that. Or third, Biden just ignores the debt limit. If push comes to shove, Biden can simply ignore it. According to two prominent law professors, University of Florida's Neil Buchanan and Cornell's Michael Dorff, Biden ought to simply defy Congress. Buchanan, who's a longtime critic of the debt ceiling, argues that if the government found itself unable to pay its bills without breaking the debt limit, doing so would be the least unconstitutional option. Interesting term, least unconstitutional. I'm going to catch my breath on that one. On the one hand, ignoring the debt limit would clearly be against the law and could and would probably lead to the president's impeachment in the House. But following the debt limit, not paying debts and picking and choosing which bills to pay, to say nothing of the more exotic and questionable options like selling off national monuments or using a $1 trillion coin, would also be illegal under current law. Now, given choice between illegal options, the professors say Biden should choose the least damaging one, which would be to continue paying bills as if the debt ceiling did not exist. There is little sign, however, that Biden is considering going either of those two routes. Should Biden decide to take that advice, the case would no doubt end up in the Supreme Court. And Buchanan said he believes the high court would decline to rule on it. But if it did take the case, the court's conservative composition would certainly favor the Republican position. The plot continues to thicken, ladies and gentlemen. The plot continues to thicken. And with all the recent talk about recession, soft landing, hard landing, and whatnot, many Americans are asking, how will we know when we're in a recession? Today, government report that the economy grew at a 1.1% annual rate last quarter signaled to at least mainstream economists and media that one of the most anticipated recessions in recent U.S. history has yet to arrive. But we're certainly getting closer to one if we're not already in one, at least partially. Many economists still expect a broad recession to hit the U.S. as soon as the current April to June quarter or soon afterward. The economy's expansion in the first 3 months of the year was modest as it was driven mostly by healthy consumer spending. Yet shoppers turned more cautious toward the end of the quarter. Businesses also cut their spending on equipment, a trend that's continued. The list of obstacles facing the economy keeps growing. And the Fed's on the verge of raising its interest rate for the 10th time since last March. Last month, the collapse of two banks resulted in a whole new threat, pullback in lending by the financial system that could further weaken growth. A report on business conditions by the Fed this month found that banks were already tightening credit to preserve capital, which makes it harder for companies to borrow and expand. Still, some glass half full economists say there are reasons to expect that an official recession, if it does come, will prove to be a comparatively mild one. They say many employers that have struggled to hire after the huge layoffs during the pandemic may decide to retain most of their workforces, even in a shrinking economy. Six straight months, that is two consecutive quarters of economic decline, or a long-held informal definition of a recession. But nothing is simple in the post-pandemic economy, where growth was negative in the first half of last year, but the job market remained robust with healthy levels of hiring. And the economy's direction has confounded Fed policymakers and many private economists ever since growth screeched to a halt in March 2020, That's when COVID struck and 22 million Americans were suddenly thrown out of work. Fed officials have made clear they're willing to tip the economy into a recession if necessary to defeat high inflation, and most economists believe them, even if markets don't necessarily. Now, has a recession already begun? Well, the clear signal would be a steady rise in job losses and a surge in unemployment. Economist Claudia Sahm, a former Fed staff member, has noted that since World War II, an increase in the unemployment rate of a half percentage point over several months has always signaled the start of a recession. Many economists monitor the number of people who seek unemployment benefits each week, a gauge that indicates whether layoffs are worsening or not. And weekly applications for jobless aid have been creeping higher as a range of companies from Facebook's parent company Meta to the industrial conglomerate 3M to the ride-hailing Lyft have announced layoffs, although they did go down a little bit last week. As Melody and I often talk about, economists monitor changes in yields on different bonds for another recession signal, the inverted yield curve. That occurs when the yield on the 10-month Treasury note falls below the yield on a shorter-term Treasury, like the 2-year or 3-month T-bill. That's unusual. Normally, longer-term bonds pay investors a higher yield in exchange for tying up their money for a longer period. Well, inverted yield curves generally mean that investors foresee a recession that will force the Fed to slash rates. Inverted curves frequently predate recessions. Yet, it can take as long as 18 to 24 months for a downturn to arrive after the yield curve inverts. Ever since last July, though, the yield in the 2-year Treasury note has exceeded the 10-year yield, suggesting that markets expect a recession sooner than later. 3-month yield has also risen, in fact, far above the 10-year yield. And that's an inversion that has even a better track record at predicting recession. In any event, recessions are officially declared by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's a group of economists whose business cycle dating committee defines a recession as a significant decline in economic activity that's spread across the economy and lasts more than a few months. Gives them a little flexibility, don't you think? Committee considers trends in hiring, looks at other data points like income, employment, inflation-adjusted spending, retail sales, factory output. Plus, it assigns a heavyweight to a measure of inflation-adjusted income that excludes government support payments, namely Social Security. Yet, the thing to remember, the NBER typically doesn't declare a recession until well after one has become. So, even though we may have been in a partial one for a while now, we possibly won't know if we're in a broader recession until well after it's begun or, in fact, is over. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your hats and stay informed. Listen to Financial Survival. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow, I believe, with Butch to close out the week. Also, be on the look for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog. Thanks always to our engineer, Todd, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.